From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I've been thinking a lot about the idea of wonder. Children have it in spades, but we adults? When was the last time you sat back and marveled at life? In a good way. At the soil beneath our feet, the grass between our toes, the air in your lungs. I think we could all use a little bit of wonder in our lives these days, so we're devoting this hour to just that. Take, for instance, a seed. What could be more hopeful than the act of planting a seed? More wonderful or awe-inspiring than watching it grow? For years, I've lobbied to get some serious talent on the show to read one of my favorite books about seeds. And here to make my dream a reality are Nevada James Sharp and Calvin Yellett George.
A fruit is a suitcase for seeds. By Gene Richards. Most plants have seeds. When you put a seed in the ground and water it, a new plant grows from it. Seeds often travel to faraway places. If seeds do not travel, too many plants will grow in one place. It will be crowded. Some seeds travel on the wind. Some seeds travel in the water. Many seeds travel inside of fruits. The fruit is like a suitcase for the seeds. It protects them on their trip. Fruits look beautiful and taste good, so animals and people eat them and drop the seeds in different places. Some fruits carry one big seed inside of them. The seed is called a pit. A cherry is one of these fruits. Some fruits have many small seeds inside of them. An apple is one of these fruits. Some fruits have many, many tiny seeds inside of them. A kiwi is one of these fruits. Many berries, such as strawberries and blackberries, carry their seeds on the outside. Raspberries do too. Some vegetables that we eat are really fruits. They carry seeds too. Peas are seeds. I bet you didn't know. Every time you eat a peach, a cherry, an avocado, a plum, a cucumber, a tomato, a grape, an apple, an orange, a pea, a melon, a banana, or a blueberry. You're really eating a suitcase for seeds.
Special thanks to Nevada James Sharp and Calvin Yellett George for that marvelous reading of one of my favorite kids' books, A Fruit is a Suitcase for Seeds by Gene Richards. And be sure to stick around to the very end of the show for the outtakes. Part of the alchemy of growing seeds includes soil. I've been drawn to soil since I made mud pies in nursery school, where some just see dirt, I see the main mediator of terrestrial life. Earlier this summer, soil scientist Dr. Ratan Lal was awarded the prestigious World Food Prize. It's considered to be equivalent to a Nobel Peace Prize in agriculture. Over his career, Dr. Lau developed and mainstreamed a soil-centric approach to increasing food production that simultaneously conserves natural resources and mitigates climate change. His techniques have helped millions of small farmers and improved the food and nutritional security of more than 2 billion people, all while saving hundreds of millions of acres of natural tropical ecosystems. Dr. Lau, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Where did this love of soil begin?
Soil, as mentioned in the previous discussion by you, has very strong connection with terrestrial life. There is no soil without life, and there is no life without soil. All good soils in the top 30 to 40 centimeter contain about 5 tons of living organisms in it. And it is those living organisms that make soil also a living entity. In fact, soil is the only place in the universe at the root-soil interface at a nanoscale where the dead biomass is resurrected back into life. So soil, a living entity, has the divine power to convert death into life. And that part of soil must be realized to understand that it should never ever be taken for granted. So it's a very important natural gift without which life on the planet as we know it would not exist.
Were you involved in farming as a child?
I grew up on a small farm in northwestern part of India, and I was raised on a small farm. Therefore, I have been in contact with, understanding, and working soils from my very childhood. Then when I went to college, I specialized my BS, MS, and PhD degree in soil. And eventually my position after college, both in Australia and then in Africa and then back in Ohio, has all been in soil.
What is the difference between dirt and soil?
That's a very good point. Soil gives life. Dirt, if anything, can take life. Dirt is something that causes diseases. It causes germs. It can cause a lot of infection. On the other hand, soil is a life-giving entity, and there's a big difference between the two. Sometime in a joke, we talk about somebody say, are you a dirt scientist? No, I'm a soil scientist. I study soil processes that are linked with the life on the planet Earth. And while I'm at that point, I might indicate I strongly believe in the concept, and this is not necessarily my concept, I believe in it, and that is the health of soil, plants, animal, people, and the environment is one and indivisible. And that goes back to the same concept of death and life being two sides of the same coin, and that coin happened to be the soil full of life, full of organism that decomposes biomass, converts into minerals, which are absorbed by the plants, and life begins again.
Are our soils in North America in trouble?
Not really. I'm very optimist. Soils in North America are, in fact, in very good shape. In fact, I take sometimes my students and foreign visitors to see several farms in Ohio, and they do a great job. I'm concerned not so much about the soil deterioration in the Midwest, but I'm concerned where there are resource-poor farmers. Let's take the example of Caribbeans, Central America, some countries, the Andean regions, Sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, where the resource-poor farmers are not able to return to the soil the biomass needed to continuously maintain the productivity of the soil. Those farmers, they take away everything from the soil because they're desperate. They take away the biomass, they take away the crop residue, they graze the cattle, and they use the cattle waste also for other purposes. So soil is left to fend by itself with no help coming in. And those soils are degraded, depleted. Some of them get extinct. Yes, soil can get extinct. There are soil which are endangered. They are going to lose their identity and productive capacity. It is the lack of understanding that the soils are also endangered and soil can also get extinct if they are abused and misused. And that is where my concern is. I think soil farmers in the Midwest, fortunately, are very progressive and by and large, very good farmers.
You know, it's so interesting because in this time, so many people are eager to blame agriculture for much of the planet's ills, in particular climate change. When you hear that, how do you respond?
I respond that those who like to blame agriculture are naive. And did you know that we perform, each one of us, an agricultural act anytime we eat? And we eat at least three times a day. So how can you blame an act on which we depend so much? I think we have a responsibility to improve it, not blame it. So agriculture has to be, because we all like food, I think if there are some who do not like food, well, that's a different part. I can understand where they come from, and I'll accept their criticism. But if everybody is like me, I like food. I really can't do without it. And I have an obligation to do something about it. That means agriculture, rather than being blamed, has to be made a solution. Many times people ask me, does regenerative agriculture work? It's not a question of it, whether it works or not. The question is how to make it work, because we can't do without it. And that's a very different way of thinking. We must bring this kind of education. Where does the food come from? It comes from soil. Where does the climate change mitigation come from? It comes from soil. Where does the better water quality come? You know, you mentioned soil and dirt. I can put it in your language. Dirt is the best media to purify the dirty water. It is the water passing through the dirt that it can come out from the other side, seeping into the river, that it's purified. So with that kind of, we really cannot blame agriculture. We have, that's a lack of education. Everybody should realize we are culprit and victims both. And we have a responsibility not to take natural resources, which are finite and fragile and very precious, for granted. We should not undervalue those resources. It's when we undervalue them that we mistreat them, and then resources suffer from the tragedy of the commons.
Thank you so much for talking to us. I feel some hope in that during this period of time where so many of us have been instructed to stay very close to home, those of us who have any area at all to garden seem to be doing so with great pleasure and joy more than ever before.
I actually do have a garden. It's a very small one. I think it's about 25 feet by 20 feet, something like that. And I harvest most of the vegetable that we consume. I'm vegetarian. I have some Asian vegetables, which I like. I spend an hour a day. And I've been doing this ever since I remember, going back to my childhood. It's really a great thing to have. And you see living things, you see nature. I get very disturbed when yesterday I was trying to plant through my rows of okra and beans. I wanted to plant radish, daikon radish. So they'll be ready to harvest in November before frost. And anytime I dig, I see earthworm, they get cut. Because I was putting a small slot through it. So you do hurt soil life, and that's the sad part of it. But the gardens are really a great educational and also a source of fresh food.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming to us and for giving us something to wonder at in this time of not so much wonderment.
Thank you so much. Bye.
That was Dr. Ratan Lal. He's a professor of soil science at Ohio State University and is the recent recipient of the World Food Prize. Coming up, marveling at the taste of trees and the last wild foods on Earth. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food. One of my favorite aspects of the expanded world of food we cover is meeting people who fall down rabbit holes of unusual subjects. Their idiosyncratic journeys often reveal something lovely about the earth and we humans, like trees and wood and flavor, the obsession of woodland biologist Artur Cesar Urlach. Hi, Artur.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. It's such an interesting book. I've always been amazed by trees and what they do. Can you tell us how long they've been on the earth?
So they have been here for 390 million years. So just a tad longer than we are.
And so they came before us, which makes me think that we were very lucky to have them. Could you explain what they do, what the column of wood actually does in terms of how it interacts with the soil and the sky?
Yeah, so the trees are basically are producing our the air that we breathe. So via the process of photosynthesis, they're transforming CO2, you know, the stuff that we just carelessly emit since just a few years now, and water together with sunlight into basically oxygen for us and sugar for them. Then they also form the soils below our feet. So they make agriculture possible at all. So they feed us. And then, of course, they also store and filter water. And given if you have a forest some 200 hectares big, it also produces its own rain.
Your background is so, your educational background is so interesting because it combines all of this biology and ecological work surrounding woodland environments. But then you also spent some time at the Slow Food University in Brás. So you also learned a lot about flavor and taste.
Yes.
And it seems like these two things came together with this passion of yours. What was the real spark that you had about investigating the flavor of wood?
So my aha moment came during my master's studies at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy, which this part of this master is to make a lot of excursions, if you want, to actually experience the food system. So not just to learn about it, but actually experience it. And this meant that we visited a lot of like very small, but also huge producers, corporations, every kind of aspect of the food system. And being in the Piemont region in Italy, where it's full of wineries, and so we often went to wineries and distilleries and got tours there. And of course, at the beginning, you know, we were introduced to the importance of terroir, so how important the very specific place of a vineyard is for the taste of the wine afterwards. And then we got, you know, they guided us through the whole process of making wine and the fermentation and how important the knowledge of the vintner is and all of that. And then towards the end, we came to where the barrels are quite often, where the, quite, for example, red wine, the famous Barolo red wine, is aged in. And at least for my taste, it was compared to the information that we got before, it was just a very short or little information. It was just, okay, those are oak barrels, either barrique or a bit bigger size. The wine stays in there for a certain amount of time. And then, yeah, in the end, we moved on normally to tasting afterwards. And for me, I also have a background as a cabinet maker. I trained as a cabinet maker during high school. And so I knew making barrels is actually really an art form. It's very difficult to make barrels because you can't use any glue. You can't use any screws to hold it together. It's poorly held together by compression, by those hoops around it, metal hoops, and still it's watertight. And I desperately wanted to know more about those barrels. So I just once after one of those tours, I just went home and started researching it. And that is really where I had kind of this light bulb moment, if you want to call it, where I discovered that wood actually influences, or in this case, wine very strongly with its flavors. But then, of course, you have whiskey, where up to 80% of the flavor and the color are actually directly from the barrel itself. And yeah, starting from there, I really discovered a whole world and where wood and trees are actually in our food, or also how they could be in our food.
You describe one of the experiences you had during the Slow Food Cheese event in the little town of Bra, where cheesemakers from all over the world gather and offer their products. You tasted this very unusual yogurt. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, this event is amazing just because it's this very beautiful little small town, very typical Italian town. And then from one day to the next, the whole town from beginning to end is filled with cheese stands from all over the world. So you have someone coming from Iceland, you have people from France, of course, and you're from the United States, and then also from Kenya. And they bring a very specific kind of cheese, maybe a little to the background. In Africa, there was never a kind of cheese-making tradition, never developed, historically speaking. However, in my perspective, they found something even more fascinating, in particular in the region of Pokot, which is in Kenya, and it's a very an area which is marked by extreme weather. So you have part time of the year, it's really dry, it's desert-like. And the other time of the year, there is a really strong rainfall, so you have a lot of water. And they, during the rainy season, they produce a lot of milk, the cows particular, and sheep and goats. But then, of course, in the dry season, they really have to seed to survive. So they can't give milk, so they just can't give it. And the people of Pocket wanted to find a way how they can preserve the milk from the rainy season also into the dry season. And this is, I don't know how they found it out, it must have been over hundreds of years, that if you use the charcoal from a very specific kind of tree, and if you make a powder out of it and mix it with the milk, it will stay fresh for up to 6 months in a desert climate without any kind of refrigeration or so. And just as an almost side product, it just tastes amazing, the yogurt. So it has kind of a blue grayish color, has the consistency of a regular yogurt, but then the flavor is more creamy, almost like a Greek yogurt. And then it's paired with all the smoky aromas from the charcoal, but also this mineral kind of sensation. So it's really good tasting, and it's amazing how long it keeps in this kind of an environment.
One of the most interesting parts of the book that I never knew about before was about this layer of the tree that sits in between the bark and the woody structure. What is that called, that layer?
The cambium.
The cambium. And you tell the story about how a really interesting Swiss cheesemaker is using it in the aging of his cheeses.
Yeah, his name is Willy Schmidt, and you really can call him the rock star, the cheese-making rock star of Switzerland. He has many awards internationally. And in the region, also in Switzerland and France, there was the tradition to use for bark around soft cheeses, because if you have a fresh soft cheese and you put it on the aging board, which is made out of wood, by the way, as well, it would just run off the board. So to keep it there, they just put a ring of bark around it. And this kind of cheese is called sanglé in French, and I think it means belted, or it has a belt around it. But Willy Schmidt, he knew this tradition, but he didn't like the flavor. And so he was looking for something similar, but has a fresher flavor. So what he came up with is to use the cambium of a tree. So that's the living layer between the dead wood in the kind of which makes up the bulk of a tree and the bark on the outside, which we see when we walk by a tree. And this living layer has quite a lot of nutrients in it. It's edible. It has very fresh flavors normally, depending on which type of tree. And so he collected this cambium from the trees, and he wraps it now around his fresh cheeses. And they have a really amazing flavor after several months of aging. On the outside, where the cheese is very close to this cambium, it has a very strong, resinous, citrusy flavor. He is using spruce cambium from spruce trees. And then, but the further in you go, the strength of the flavor goes down, but then you have much more nuanced notes also in there. And it's a really amazing kind of cheese, which is perfect, for example, in winter, also in the oven. So you bake it and then eat it with a very dark rye bread, and it's a perfect combination.
Mm, sounds so good. Was there a big indigenous tradition of eating the cambium?
Yes, yeah, very much so, all over the world. In North America, of course, there is the Adirondack, which I think many people in North America know, just from, even if you don't know, it was a tribe. And it's actually an almost derogatory name, because it's called the tree eaters. Because other tribes came to their territories and saw that they were removing the bark, or what they thought was the bark, but it was actually the cambium from the trees, and saw that they don't know how to hunt or how to, you know, forage for other kinds of food, and thought, okay, they're not very smart and they just eat the trees. Whereas in reality, they were extremely smart, because this cambium is full of vitamin C, for example, and all other very valuable nutrients. And this was also known by the Sami people, which are in the north of Finland and Norway. There are some tribes which used to live so far north that it's above the tree belt, so there aren't any forests around them. And one of the most valuable gifts those tribes living in forested areas could bring to the tribes living in non-forested areas was actually dried cambium. They ate it and prevented scurvy in this way. So, and they made bread from it and cookies and all kinds of different dishes. So it was nowadays you would call it a superfood.
Well, thank you so much, Artur. What a wonderful book. It's just packed with great stories. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Artur Caesar Erlach. His book is The Flavor of Wood. We're living in a world that we think we can control. For some, the reaction to that is to seek out places of wildness that still remain. Gina Ray LaCerva went on a years-long search for the last untamed foods on Earth and came away with stories that give us much to think about as we live through a time that reminds us of how little control we actually have. Hi, Gina Ray.
Hi, Evan.
Oh, it's so great to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Where did you grow up and what was your relationship to the natural world there?
So I grew up in New Mexico, just outside of Santa Fe, and we lived on about 20 acres of high desert mountain. And I kind of self-identified as a feral child. So I spent a lot of time outside alone by myself, wandering around in the arroyos, observing nature, and just kind of entertaining myself. So the natural world has long been, you know, a close friend and a point of reference for me.
Often these days, when we think about this idea of foraging or looking for the wild, nostalgia comes into play, this nostalgia for the lost wild. But you talk about how this is not new.
Right. This was such an interesting part of my research, was to find out that people have been kind of elevating wild foods for a really long time. And this sort of almost like a cyclical nature to people's desire for more simple back-to-the-land foods. I found examples in, you know, the late Roman Empire where the poet Horace was, you know, he was looking at the farmer in his field and the hunter and really envying their sort of simple life and their simple food. He was really sick of the lavish, elaborate banquets that he was used to. And then again, at various periods during the Renaissance and the early 20th century in America, people, you know, Thoreau, people like that really elevated this idea of kind of natural foods, wild foods, as a response to kind of the excessiveness of civilization or the industrialization of food. But, you know, so it was really cool to see the cycle coming back and forth throughout history.
I would love if we could talk about ramps, this food that absolutely besots eaters in the eastern part of the United States each fall. You talk about it in the book as an example of a food with indigenous power, colonial poverty, and current luxury.
Right. So, you know, ramps were an incredibly important food source for a lot of indigenous American cuisines. It was some of the first wild plants that emerged after winter. So for tribes such as the Cherokee, ramps were very spiritually important. They were medicinal. They were nutritious. But when colonists first came to the United States, the smell of them was actually associated with poverty. So, you know, you would only eat them if you had nothing else to eat. And so it's been really interesting to see now, you know, 200 years later, that it's such a coveted item for foodies.
And that seems to be this sort of drumbeat that returns over and over again, these pulls of what you called a fetishization of need.
Right. So, you know, the idea is kind of like as something becomes scarcer, there's suddenly a newfound interest in it. So something like wild plants that we don't eat very frequently in our diets have become elevated now in the context of high cuisine. And restaurants are, you know, essentially serving weeds, but because they're not part of our everyday diet, it's a new flavor. It's a novel taste experience.
It's so interesting. It's like either luxury or desperation. The thread about just living in harmony with the natural world seems to be missing.
Yeah. I mean, part of what I was looking at in this book was how these different wild foods started out as really about survival, or you ate it because it was all you had. And now increasingly, many, many wild foods are only available as luxury commodities. They're only available to people who have the time or the money to go out and source them.
Given that we evolved as hunter-gatherers, it's kind of interesting to think of what man's relationship has been historically to hunting. It's always seemed so tied to place, and that place is geography, weather, and culture. And now a lot of those ties to place have been severed. So where does that leave us? And where in the world did you travel to look at hunting that was still tied to a place?
Right. So, you know, hunters used to actually pattern their lives after the animals that they hunted. So it may mean that you were following a herd throughout the seasons. And I think it's really interesting that now we primarily stay in one place and our food travels the globe to come find us. So we've definitely lost that connection to place-based foods. So I was curious to go out and find places where people were still very much reliant on the land around them. And the research brought me from Sweden to the Democratic Republic of Congo, all the way to Borneo to try and seek out some of these foods.
So let's talk about the Democratic Republic of the Congo and bushmeat, where context is everything.
Yeah, so it's a very, very complicated issue. Conservationists have been concerned with the bushmeat trade, which is the trade in wild animals from the forest. For a very long time, I think over 50 years, people have been discussing this problem. And yet, when you talk to people who are living there, it's very much eating wild game meat is part of the culture. It's a food for celebration. It's a food for family gatherings. So much as we might eat turkey on Thanksgiving, people will eat wild game meat for weddings, things like that. So trying to understand these really complicated links between culture, between environment, was fascinating for me to research. The other issue in the Congo has been that over the last couple decades, you've had a lot of civil war, you've had automatic weapons coming into the forests. And so what used to be more about subsistence hunting has now become much more of a market economy. And so you have these kind of roving poacher gangs coming into forest land and shooting down, you know, a whole troop of monkeys or a whole herd of bush pig, and then bringing that meat to market in urban areas. So people who grew up hunting as a means of subsistence are now more frequently actually selling the wild game meat as a source of cash rather than eating it.
There's a quote in the book that I would love for you to read. It starts with, "If a white man kills a wild animal."
If a white man kills a wild animal and eats it, we call it hunting game. Sometimes the animal is called venison. Other times it is named deer, elk, moose. If a black man kills a wild animal and eats it, we call it bushmeat poaching. The animals are too numerous to name, and so it is merely called flesh, protein, meat.
During the process of doing all the research and the travel necessary for your work, women turn up again and again. Could you just speak to the role of women in all of this?
Yeah, so women are the primary food producers around the world. And yet that knowledge and that respect for that is often silent. So part of what I wanted to do in this book was really try and bring out those stories of the role of women in food production, both, you know, historically as the primary gatherers. Really, we should call ourselves gatherer hunters because the majority of our food came from gathering, the majority of our calories. And yet, you know, these stories were not written down historically. One of the examples I like to give is that probably the oldest human tool was the woven satchel used to bring gathered food home, but they disintegrate in the archaeological record. And so we're left only with stone tools. And so throughout this research, I really wanted to try and uncover and retell those stories of women's food and environmental knowledge that have been lost. And, you know, I think part of it too is that, you know, the daily meal is sort of this humble thing that we don't think that much about. And yet it's really incredible that women feed the world day in and day out. They are the primary source of our survival, and we don't give them credit for that. So how to elevate the sort of basic mundane aspect of our lives into something that really is truly miraculous?
Yeah, I've always thought that women who cook every day for their families are heroes.
Yeah, they should be getting awards for that. And I think with the quarantine and with COVID, people are starting to recognize that a bit, like, oh, I have to cook again, you know? We're starting to see really the beautiful labor that's involved in feeding ourselves on a daily basis.
I loved reading the book, and I loved both conversations I've had with you, one at Now Serving and this one. Thank you so much, Gina Ray.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Evan. Thank you so much.
That was Gina Ray LaServa. Her book is Feasting Wild. Next, The Wonder of Mold. We talked to a passionate duo about the teeny tiny fungal spores that transform the ordinary into the undeniably delicious. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. You may not know it, but chances are you love koji. If you've enjoyed miso, soy sauce, rice vinegar, sake, amazake, soju, or mirin, then you've had koji. It's a precursor, an initiator of what Jeremy Umansky and Rich Shi would say is a kind of alchemy. Jeremy is chef and co-owner of Larder Delicatessen and Bakery in Cleveland, Ohio, and Rich is the exhibit engineer at the Museum of Food and Drink in New York City. They've paired their fandom of koji and fermentation to explore Koji Alchemy, the name of their new book. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello. We're so excited to be on the show. Longtime fans.
I love the fact that the two of you are such tight geeks in this exploration, but don't live anywhere near one another. Was there a time that you did live near one another?
No. We've always been at an arm's length. And Evan, we prefer to be called nerds.
Sorry. I'm very sorry. Okay, so Jeremy, in short, what is koji? And how is it different from other molds or versions of fermentation around the world?
So koji is a mold. And we have to keep in mind that a mold is a type of fungi. And when we think fungi, a lot of us will think oyster mushrooms or white button mushrooms, that sort of thing. It is very similar in a lot of respects, except it's macroscopic. It's very hard to see with the naked eye. And the wonderful thing about it is a living organism. And to live and to survive and thrive, it needs to grow on its food source. And when it does that, it secretes these various enzymes, these very important types of proteins. And all these different enzymes do specialized tasks, meaning as it's growing on its food source, let's say rice, it's breaking down the starches in rice into simple sugars and the inherent protein that's there into very tasty amino acids. And even some of the fats that are there into these fatty acids and esters that are highly aromatic and very sensual and just smell fantastic. So as koji does this, we realized we could use this to our advantage and use it to kickstart fermentation. You can't just simply ferment rice or beans. The bacteria responsible for doing that can't access these long chains of starches and other complex proteins in the food. They need them as simple and as small as possible to actually ferment them into these familiar sour foods. So koji does the hard work ahead of time and then allows us to reap the benefits of deliciousness.
Can you describe what the characteristic aroma is?
So I can't do it as well as Jeremy because he has a more romantic look than I do. But if you can imagine, you know, the most fruity and aromatic smell that has sort of a combination of honeysuckle, grapefruit, chestnuts, with, you know, some level of, you know, hint of, you know, sort of mold funk to it. It's just intoxicating. And I think one thing that I always will remember is Cynthia Graber, who was the host of Gastropod. She describes it as something that she would put on as a perfume.
I remember the first time I was handed a little pot of shiokoji and was told to add it to soup. That's what I was told. If you want to know what it does, add it to something that the taste isn't there yet. You're trying to get the taste somewhere you want it to be. And so I took it home and it's, you know, this white slurry. And I did that. I had made like a minestrone or something that I would normally make, and it just wasn't there yet. And normally I would have just continued to add more salt or maybe more garlic to get it to where I wanted it. But instead I added a couple tablespoons of the shiokoji. And it was like it was like this magical alchemy that happened. So describe to us about these amino pastes and how these things manage to infiltrate flavor in this kind of magical way.
So I think in the context of amino paste, it just comes down to the fact that you can, aside from using soybeans and rice and barley as, you know, constituents to start koji and be able to create these conversions and complex flavors, as you noticed, with adding just a little bit of shiokoji to your soup, you have a level of a tiny bit of umami that's created by the inherent proteins in the rice that create this boosted flavor. And you can achieve this with pretty much any protein and any starch. So if you can imagine that, you know, applying shiokoji to, say, you know, put it in an application where you would make a pickle, where you have potentially, you know, only a little bit of protein that's part of the context, that little bit of protein creates a little bit of amino acids that creates that touch of flavor and sweetness that just brings up the level of the food such that it tastes better than itself. One of the things that I experimented early on was using some ricotta. And basically, I made a ricotta miso that I let sit for a couple months in the fashion of a miso, and it created this level of Parmesan, sort of blue cheese flavor in such a short period of time because you're leveraging these enzymes to create these amino acids. Because in the normal processing of aging food, you have these microbes that come along the way to create these enzymes, but they're much lower in loading. So you have to wait a much longer period of time.
We should say that we're using the word amino paste as an analog in a way for miso. It's a more expansive way of talking about miso.
Correct.
Okay, so we're getting a little nerdy, and I don't want to lose people. So let's just throw out a few like easily understandable things to do. Let's say a koji cured egg yolk.
So a koji cured egg yolk is something that's fantastic. And it's as simple as obtaining some shiokoji. If you don't have the time to invest and make your own shiokoji, you can easily source either from a local Japanese market or via different online retailers, a little Tetra Pak of it already made. And you simply separate your egg yolk from your egg, put it in the shiokoji in a shallow dish, so it's laying kind of flat in there, and let it sit for an hour, maybe 2 hours. After that, you can take that egg yolk and put it on top of a bowl of ramen and just let it be runny and saucy and delicious all over. Or you can dry it out a little bit and you have something that is just as delicious as Parmesan cheese to grate over pasta or over a nice Caesar salad.
So amazing, this stuff. It really is like one of the wonders of our Earth environment, I have to say. So many people these days are baking. So let's give them some ideas that they can use in baking?
I think one of the best and straightforward ones is one that Rich opened my eyes to. And in most cookie recipes or even a scone recipe, something that's got a heavier batter, simply replace the salt that is called for in the recipe with equal parts of miso or any other amino paste. And you're going to end up with, you know, we all love like a salted caramel or, you know, a salted chocolate chip cookie. You're going to end up with that complexity, but way beyond anything you've ever had before. And I think that's one of the easiest ways to jump in.
And just to have some level of understanding of, you know, a really simple way of diving into that is that you can just add a tablespoon of some dark miso to a cup of sugar and use that as you would in your baking. And it adds these caramely complex flavors that you wouldn't otherwise have without that ingredient. And one of the coolest things about that sugar is that you can use it in the context of, you know, sweetening a drink, as with, you know, sort of an iced tea or a kombucha if you want to sweeten it up or load it up with a little bit of umami. One of the things that I would often do is I would make, you know, a miso milk, depending on the weather. You can either make a, you know, a hot miso milk or a cold miso milk with this miso sugar. And that would be a great introduction for people to understand, okay, this is another context of using an umami product that was outside of the general understanding of using it for a savory purpose.
I want to thank the two of you. What an incredible manual you've created to get people thinking about another rabbit hole to dive down after they have mastered sourdough. I think everybody's looking for a summer project now.
They've got the perfect one. It's the perfect time of year to start some miso or a different amino sauce and tuck it away. So thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Rich Shee and Jeremy Umansky. Their book is Koji Alchemy, Rediscovering the Magic of Mold-Based Fermentation. Coming up, when farmers markets adapted to COVID guidelines set forth by the city, they shut out a lot of prepared food vendors who rely on those markets for their livelihood. That story next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. This week, we're bringing the market report in studio to discuss the ban of prepared food vendors from farmers markets during the pandemic. Brother and sister team Carol and Philip Kwan are behind Mama Musubi. Hello, Carol and Philip.
Hello.
Hi, Evan.
Carol, you have a finance background. When did you decide to shift gears and team up with your brother, Philip?
You know, it was just really perfect timing. I moved back down from the Bay Area where I went to school, and we both actually have financial backgrounds working in corporate. And we really wanted to have a really good, wholesome product in a fast casual environment. And the idea just kind of stuck with us. So we decided to test the idea at our first 626 night market food festival in 2012.
And can you describe the product?
So it's Japanese rice balls that's made out of rice, and inside you can fill it with any type of protein. In Japan, they're all over 7-Elevens, convenience stores, to train stations, and even at your home where your mom's making it for you for your lunch to school.
And this rice ball is often in a triangular form, and you eat it by putting a bit of nice crispy nori, roasted nori around it.
Correct.
I mean, really, really delicious. So prior to the pandemic, give us a sense of what your business was.
Prior to the pandemic, I think a little history would paint a better picture here is what Carol was saying earlier of us starting at these food festivals. We start at one food festival, two food festival, and three. And we ended up starting also at farmers markets and learning really the ropes of food and beverage. Because we both don't come from that industry, we really wanted to learn and grow organically. So we got the very fortunate opportunity to start at Altadena's Farmers Market, which is one of our is the first farmers market we started at. And, you know, like I was saying earlier, 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 farmers markets. And so although folks might see us once a week, we're really open almost like 7 days a week. So we were, from a standpoint of a food and beverage business, we were full time.
So, Carol, tell us when you found out that fresh food vendors were going to be banned from the farmers markets once they reopened.
Sure. So we noticed that, I think it was right where it was mid-March. We did our last Sunday event and we had to make that decision of just shutting down. And as this was happening, our farmers market managers were communicating to us that we were not allowed to come back to the markets just yet. They need to figure out the whole social distancing. And I think 2 weeks after that, they allowed us to go back in. But health department came out and decided that prepared food vendors were not allowed. So we had to stop again. And we have been out since April until now. The only thing that we could do and pivot in July, we were offered to come in as a prepackaged food vendor, which meant that we would have to apply for different licenses. And even for some businesses like ours, have to really change our business model overnight.
And also it would really impact the quality of the product, because the beauty of buying one of your rice balls from an eater perspective is that you're scooping out the warm rice right then and filling it and handing it over. And so it's would be so different if it were a refrigerated product.
Correct. So we've been using this whole time during this pandemic to really see how do we pivot. And we thought about if we could have gone into the prepackaged vendor, it was just very difficult for us because it would be a whole different experience. So that's why we had to like step back and just wait.
It's so strange. I mean, I can understand them making this decision right at the beginning, but now that restaurants have figured out how to do to go, it seems that a lot of worry would be sort of disappear now. How has the ban affected your staffing and sales?
You know, it's very unfortunate in that overnight, our sales drop 80%. And as you know, in the food world, in the restaurant world, your margins are not big. And dropping even 20% makes it very difficult. Dropping 80% is almost a nail in the coffin. So it's sad that we lost 80% of the sales, but we are very much hoping that the ideas and the things that we're working on will be successful in the coming, you know, months.
Carol, are you aware of any initiatives or appeals to repeal the ban of prepared food vendors at farmers markets?
Right now, I know Esther Walker from Studio City has been really trying to repeal it and see if they can ban other farmers market managers to work on this. But nothing that I know of is actually happening on the health department side to respond. I think their only response is that due to it being outdoors, people will be ordering food and they will be taking off their masks and eating. But I know that we've talked about different safety precautions because we have our team. You know, we used to have our team of 17 people and we're now at 4. And we're doing everything that we can to operate in a really safely manner for our team and for our guests. So, you know, we talked about even just having takeout already so you can order whether it's in front or ahead of time, and the customer would come to the farmer's market, pick it up, and take it home or take it somewhere else to eat. So these are some of the ideas and proposals that we have, but we have yet to hear from health department to listen and try to come up with a regulation that will work for all of us.
Very, very interesting. Thank you so much, Carol and Philip, for coming on. And I hope the health department talks to a bunch of people and realizes that it can be done safely.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us on.
That's siblings Carol and Philip Kwan of Mama Musubi. We've been talking about the ban of prepared food vendors at local farmers markets during the pandemic. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Tan, Kenny Ng. I also want to thank Alex Brown, who wrangled the talent at the top of today's episode, and who also sent us the outtakes.
Fruits look beautiful and tasty, so animals and people eat them and drop the seeds in different places with their poop. La la, some priests have tiny seeds in them. Poop!
Can you try it without the poop?
No.
Oh, okay. A suitcase for seeds.
A bed for poo poo butt.
A suitcase for seeds.
Shout out to all the parents out there. Until next week, smell the flowers. Just take a beat to soak in the wonder that surrounds us. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.